Hello, everyone. It's Angelo Robles at Family Office Association. In today's audio podcast, I'm here with my friend Sam Wan, founder and managing director, Global Risk Management Advisors. Hello, Sam. How are you?
I'm fine, Angelo. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fantastic. Such a pleasure to connect. We're going to have a conversation today about risk management, specifically as it pertains to financial wealth, which I believe is one of the most important, if not the foundation of importance when it comes to making strategic investing. On that note, Sam, let's get right to it. If you don't mind, for our audience, define the meaning of risk management as it does pertain to the financial wealth of a wealthy family or a single family office.
I'd be happy to answer that question. Risk management in the relationship to financial wealth really needs to be thought of in two segments. The first segment is that family offices should care about is protection of assets or wealth preservation. And then the second important factor they need to think about is how can they have growth in that wealth over time in a sound in a sustainable manner. And so with that, the kinds of risks that family offices should be aware of really fall into several buckets. The first is market or price risk, meaning that the price of their investment or their asset is subject to going down, and that decline can happen many times in market cycles very dramatically, as it did in the 2008 financial crisis, where S&P went down 38.5%. The other kind of risks that families should also be aware of in relationship to their investments or their investment portfolio are liquidity risk, and that is are the investments that they've made liquid to meet their liabilities or their other financial needs. In the financial crisis, one of the things that became evident was credit or counterparty risk. And by credit or counterparty risk, many families saw institutions such as a Lehman or Bear Stearns, that had been around for hundreds of years, disappear. They also saw investments in their portfolio that might have been AAA rated that were in fact not AAA rated. And so the financial crisis brought to the forefront that credit and counterparty risk, liquidity risk, are very much risk factors that affect all investors, but in particular family office investors because of the size of their portfolios. The other kind of risk that family offices should also be aware of is leverage risk. And that is in a number of their investments, there is either implicit or explicit leverage. Typically, this kind of leverage is found in their alternatives investment portfolio, in investments, whether it's in hedge funds or private equity. Finally, the other risk that family offices need to be cognizant of is what we call concentration risk. And that's a fancy way of saying that sometimes family offices have too much of their wealth concentrated in a few eggs within the nest.
Absolutely. Sticking to potentially the definition from a financial perspective and to kind of bring our audience into the challenges that they face in effectively defining risk, probably a classic definition, risk is the probability that an investment return will differ from its average historical return during a defined investment period. I suppose that you can't make acute decisions if you can't measure risk. What are some of the metrics that an organization or a family could do to help truly? And I know we have multiple levels of risk here. You described a couple of them, liquidity, credit, leverage, more applicable to alternatives. Where does a family even start?
The starting point, that's a great question, Angelo, and it's a question that we get asked often. The correct starting point for a family office, if they're going to do more formal and what we call institutional quality style risk management, begins with governance and a risk management framework. That is what is the sort of the top down, and that is also what makes it possible to have actionable risk management, because metrics alone won't give a family office or any other institutional investor guidance on what to do about your risk. So when we work with family offices, the first place we start is in creating an investment policy statement. And for some families where they have family members that sit on a board of a foundation or an endowment would be familiar with this document. This document essentially defines what your investment approach is, your investment charter. It also defines what you do for risk management, what the roles and responsibilities of the family members are, to the extent that there's some kind of committee within the family that is an investment or risk management committee. It defines the roles and responsibilities. As an addendum to this document, what typically you would want to have in place are risk policy guidelines. And these risk policy guidelines effectively define the risk budget or the risk tolerance level for a family. This is very, very important because you can't begin to do any kind of risk-based asset allocation. You can't begin to do any risk management if there is no benchmark against which you are governing your risks, because you haven't defined what your appetite or budget for risk is. So let me give you a few examples to make it more sort of tangible. The typical kinds of things that would be in this risk policy guideline that would be an addendum or a subset of the family office's investment policy statement would be things such as what's the family's limit or tolerance for drawdown in their investments? In other words, how much do you feel comfortable losing before you're going to escalate or take some escalated action, meaning go to cash or redeem from investments? There would also be, within these risk policy guidelines, guidelines about the kinds of investments that are permissible, the kind of asset allocation that the family's comfortable with. There might be also guidelines around credit or counterparty risk, liquidity, leverage, volatility, often expressed as by value at risk, or VAR, as it's known to some people. So all of these kinds of documents essentially create a parameter, if you'll call it that, and define the family's objectives for investment, and it also defines what their risk is. Now, if you define what your investment objectives and what your risk are, and you understand that risk and return work in an inverse nature, then it sets the foundation by which the family can now begin to try to govern its risk, because the governance has been defined in that investment policy statement. The thresholds and the parameters have been defined in that risk policy guideline. And then to your earlier question, you're absolutely correct, Angelo, in that you cannot manage what you don't measure and monitor. So it is critical that family offices are able to have meaningful metrics that give them an idea of what their market, credit, liquidity, counterparty, leverage risks are in any single investment. But then it's critical that they understand, with the correlative effects, what the risks are in their aggregate portfolio. And when I mean aggregate portfolio, I mean both their liquid investments, such as long only, as well as their illiquid investments, such as real assets, hedge fund investments, private equity investments, etc. And so what I just described is not only the starting point, but it's really the basis for the framework for risk management that families need to understand and must have in place if they're really going to be doing any kind of meaningful and actionable risk management.
And that effectively implies institutional quality or level risk management, which, let's be honest, Sam, the vast majority of SFOs, even ones that are very large and often sophisticated, often this is overlooked. I would like to circle back, and we may hit upon the importance of the investment policy statement and some of the parameters that should be outlined there. But before that, and you also noted it in your commentary, governance. Now, sometimes you don't hear that word too often as it relates to the world of investing, or specifically the risk management portion. If you don't mind, give our audience even a little deeper and more granular perspective of what something pertaining to governance would entire include. Is it a combination of people within the family? Is it a written document structured by legal people? How would they even go about setting governance as it pertains to risk management?
That's a great question, and I'm happy to try to tackle it. Governance, at the end of the day, really can be used as a synonym for manage, but management done well. And you're absolutely correct that a typical family office, an SFO, we observe in our extensive experience that they don't have the internal staff, they don't have the systems, and they don't have the know-how to really properly do risk management. And that's one of the reasons, and it is not meant to be self-serving, why we exist as a firm to facilitate that and to help these families to better manage and to better govern those risks. But to answer, you know, how does this all work? Part of the answer lies in the fact that your question was a good one. So if you had asked that question to me as a yes or no type of question, I would have said all of the above, meaning that in order for there to be good governance or good management of risk within a family office or an SFO, you've got to have that document which really defines who's doing what your appetite for risk is, and how you're going to affect within E that risk management in the way that the family invests, redeems, monitors, and manages their investment portfolio. So that document needs to spell out all those things. And so one of the things that I often get asked is, they say, we like the fact that you talk about actionable risk management. What is actionable risk management? Well, what actionable risk management means is, if you have that budget for risk so you don't get over your skis, you know that you have a boundary for how much volatility or how much drawdown that the portfolio could suffer. And that's usually measured against a scenario such as, a scenario that a lot of our clients are particularly interested in is, if we were to have another 2008, how much could we lose in that investment portfolio? And is within our parameters for risk, within our tolerance levels. So that's the kind of metric. And then you would need to establish formal processes to say, if we fall outside of that risk budget or the parameter, what is supposed to happen? And so that is typically called an escalation policy, where members of the family or a committee, in this case a sort of a risk and investment management committee, and we highly recommend that in order not to be too insular or inbred, so to speak, that it does make sense to have some qualified people, and I underscore qualified people, that have the investment and risk management chops to be able to independently and neutrally serve on a governance committee for a family. In other words, it can't be somebody who's trying to sell you an investment or sell you an asset allocation. And so if you establish these processes, and the kind of processes we think are important to having effective governance, which translates into actionable risk management, is before I make the next investment, what is the process that the family must go through in terms of due diligence, in terms of making sure that it's the risk parameters or risk budget, in terms of downside analysis? Because even the most brilliant investors, it doesn't matter if you're Warren Buffett, make mistakes. And so you want to make sure that if you do make a mistake, there is a process in place to defease risk, or in other words, cut your losses. And so that needs to be a written process. There should be a formal process by which you periodically monitor your investments, your managers, against benchmarks and against your risk policy guidelines to see if they are performing as intended and as expected. And if they're not, part of that process would call for putting them on some kind of watch list, and then the next level of escalation would be redemption. And so by doing all of these things, we've created now a formal process for what needs to happen if you invest the next dollar. You've also created a formal process by which you are objectively, both quantitatively and qualitatively, monitoring your investments to ensure that they meet the family's investment objectives and expectations for why you invested with them, and also, very importantly, that it's within the confines of your risk policy statement or your risk budget or your risk parameters. And so by doing these things, this is how you take things that might seem in an investment policy statement to be pie in the sky, and you make it actionable, because now you've brought it down to the weeds, haven't you, into how you invest, how you monitor in the investments, what triggers a redemption. And so this is how one creates actionable risk management, and that all starts with good governance.
Absolutely. Very well explained. So we understand the importance, although we could spend hours on some of these subjects, we are going to have to move along. But governance and a risk management framework are critical, integral. Having an investment policy statement and then having the decisions from allocation come from that, pending various issues with the family, from needs pertaining to liquidity and risk and time horizon that they want to take. So moving from that, what many families don't even have really truly complete, and what's the word I'm looking for, in terms of collecting all their data from various feeds or using a service that does that for them, especially if they have a complex portfolio of alternatives or a lot of illiquids. So to do post the governance, the investment policy statement, but to really do risk management properly, whether internally or in conjunction with an organization like yours, they're really going to have to know what they own. And often in a large, complex portfolio, isn't it integral that they have some type of aggregation and reporting system?
That's exactly right. These, as I mentioned earlier, you cannot manage what you don't measure and monitor. And then in terms of measuring and monitoring, it has to be against something or versus something. And that's why it's versus the investment policy statement and more specifically the risk policy guidelines. And so most the systems that are out there that would allow a family to robustly, and I emphasize the word robustly, be able to look at an investment or a sleeve of investments, meaning fixed income versus equities, and be able to meaningfully look at both performance and risk, which are, as you know, inexorably linked, these systems, unfortunately, are not plug-and-play systems, so they're not systems that you just put a CD-ROM in your laptop or computer and hit enter a few times when it prompts you to say next, and it says completed and successfully installed. What we usually find is that most families use an Excel spreadsheet, and they'll use a very junior person, sometimes a person with an accounting background, that will merely take the statements that they receive from their various investments or asset managers, and they put in what their original cost basis was, and they put in the most recent NAV kind of number or valuation number, and that's about it. Unfortunately, that doesn't tell you anything about your risk. It doesn't tell you anything about how it's doing versus what you intended or how performance is. And so what we've seen other families do is, in order to try to get something better than an Excel spreadsheet, which merely is a blotter for their what they've invested in, they've tried to go to some inexpensive services that give them some generic metrics about, well, the hedge fund average is this, or S&P is, up 3% this year. And unfortunately, that becomes at an elevation that is so high that would be like trying to read, a map that somebody's looking at on the sidewalk as you fly by in a plane, at 30,000 feet. Impossible, right? And so those kind of metrics, which we've seen families try to use as just a sort of general compass, is also relatively worthless and not meaningful, because the elevation is A, too high, and it's not specific to the investments they've made. And so that's where the utility is lost. The thing that we see as the very much the minority is when families typically say, okay, I get it that an Excel spreadsheet doesn't tell me what my risk or performance is. If I use a couple of these sort of database kind of services, it just tells me generically where things are at. It doesn't really, it's not specific to my particular portfolio. And then if they do some inquiry or diligence and they have some of the vendors come in, they realize quickly that these systems are very, very expensive and would require their own team of sort of risk management professionals and investment professionals. And so that first visit from the vendor becomes the last visit, and then they choose to live in what we call denial. And as a friend of mine says, we're not talking a river. Those are typically the kinds of mistakes that we see. And so that leaves you with where most families are, unfortunately. And they just think if they pick good managers and if they get a good market cycle, they'll be okay. And they just rely on sort of, wishfulness as their tool for risk management, unfortunately.
Well, then let's take that a little bit of a step further. You mentioned how most families do it, and again, even sophisticated, often multi-billion dollar families. Now, some families will tell me that part of the reason why they keep it a little bit secretive and they keep it all internal, however, they're not going to have the resources to do true analytics. Sometimes it could be cost, although obviously that's very short-sighted relative to managing risk, which should be critical. But the other one that I think is important for them is simply privacy. Even when they have agreements with organizations that do quality aggregation and reporting, in theory, there are multiple prying eyes, for lack of a better word, that are quote-unquote seeing their stuff. Nonetheless, let's get past that. We spoke about the challenges and how most families do it. How would explain to my audience how they could do it more correct? Don't necessarily give maybe specific company names on aggregation and reporting, but what would be the right way to do it?
The right way to do it would be ideally to work with the right people that have the experience to be able to provide reports. Most families, as you know, Angelo, did not make their money by being in the investment management business. So we firmly believe that whatever reporting metrics. Has to be something that the family can understand and utilize in managing their investments. It cannot the expectation. It's unreasonable, in our opinion, if the expectation is they have to get a PhD in finance and a CFA, and then they'll be able to understand the reports that they receive. That's unreasonable. So, you know, along with those reports, they very much, we find, need the guidance and the interpretation from somebody who's a neutral or independent party, and that's very, very important because it cannot be from one of the usual suspects, such as the sort of investment or pension consultant who are charged with doing asset allocation and manager selection. It's important to remember you can't be both the maker and the checker. And so the reports that typically would make sense for most families, because unless you're a family such as the Soros family or the Ziff brothers, who are actively managing their risk on a day-to-day basis, and in the case of the Soroses, they are actually principally investing and principally trading investments. That's if you wanted the sort of the penultimate, that would be one extreme. The other extreme, unfortunately, which is the larger segment, are the people who are doing largely nothing and hoping that wealth just begets wealth. So the kinds of things in terms of reporting that would make sense would be, in our opinion, typically on a quarterly basis. And in that quarterly report, it should have a breakdown that mirrors those risk policy guidelines of what does my liquidity risk look like, what does my leverage risk look like, and it should be at both the investment level and at the aggregate sleeve level. So when I say the investment level, let's say that a family has invested in Elliott Associates, you know, a specific hedge fund. It should show you what your risk profile looks like there, but then it should, in aggregate, show you what your risk profile looks like for the 10 other hedge fund investments you've made. And then it should be benchmarked against the specific strategy or style. So if it's multi-strat or long-short equity or global macro, that's the benchmark that it should be shown against. And then you can clearly see, is my, you know, investment, are they doing better than their peers, and are they producing alpha, or are they just giving me beta?
Now, if you don't mind me interrupting you, because I think you made a very important point, for families that have alternatives, whether an intimate number or a large number, my experience is oftentimes there's really not a great sense of coordination with the alternatives as a part of their portfolio. Well, these are alternative managers. They're hedging my downside risk. That is way, way too broad of an overstatement. And by the way, often likely not going to be true in the aggregate of their portfolio. You noted the one fund, which is a very successful one and very large. Would you look into it and analyze for the family, or simply, is this something they should know? Not only how it compares to a specific benchmark, but what kind of credit risk, how much leverage, do the partners or founders have a specific percentage of their capital in the fund? And I guess my broad question would be, are there ways to measure and get that, or is the community so private and closed you can't even dig that deeply into it?
The answer is that the first part of your question, my answer is yes, and that is a family needs to know those kinds of things. And that is, if we use Elliott, which is a very fine firm, and I have a lot of respect for them, is that they are taking leverage risk. They do have credit and counterparty risk. They do have concentration risk. And so you have to understand that. And then the other thing that somebody has to understand, they're managing now many tens of billions of dollars, and if you believe the data, that it becomes harder to invest effectively the more money that you manage. That's something that somebody who is invested let's say if they're currently invested with Elliott, should be looking at, and I'm not recommending redemption, so I don't want people to read into what I'm saying, but it is something that we recommend that people should be monitoring because size matters. And for hedge funds, there's a lot of data that shows that once you get to a larger size, it's to deploy that money effectively and produce good alpha. And so there are also qualitative considerations. In answer to the data being available, more and more transparency is available. So if you look at institutional investors pre and post 2008, pre-2008, the transparency that most institutional investors got outside of their long-only investments, which, by the way, they can get 100% transparency there, on the alternative side, it was in the neighborhood of 50 to 60%. If you look today, that percentage is now north of 80%, and most institutional investors, and our definition of institutional investors is endowments, foundations, pensions, and the more sophisticated family offices. Within that group, the majority are using managed account vehicles, which require that they get transparency. And so within that bucket, it's 100%. And so when we work with...
I'm sorry, Sam, continue.
So when we work with families, because we have that underlying data, we're able to do very granular and robust analysis. And so for a family, if they have the internal capabilities, the system staff to do that, the data is there now, which they can do meaningful risk benchmarking, performance attribution analysis. And that kind of analysis, we would recommend an interval of no less than quarterly. And either semi-annually or annually, there should be some review mechanism by which these things are formally reviewed and discussed.
If it is an LP interest, whether an organization like yours or the family internally inquiring to the GP or fund, will they often be able to obtain much of what they need?
Today, yes. I mean, prior to the financial crisis, that group, the hedge fund, private equity group in particular, was very full of themselves. And so they made investors feel as if they should be grateful to be an LP. Today, that smugness is gone from, I would say, 98% of that universe. And they realize that it's the other way around. And so our experience has been that in most cases, if we don't get 100% transparency, we're able to get enough transparency, which we can do reverse engineering and other parallel analysis to have meaningful metrics about concentration risk, leverage, liquidity, volatility. And those are the kind of things that a family, as I mentioned earlier, needs to understand in order to say that they understand what their investment risks are and to understand whether their investments are working out as intended and how they're doing versus, peers, as well as the determination that one needs to make is if I had taken that money and done something else with it, what would that, opportunity return been or the opportunity cost been?
I'm suppose going to ask you kind of a layup question for what you do in your community, but shockingly, even with sophisticated institutional investors and family offices, this still happens way too much. And that would be, again, a large allocating family. And let's assume they have multiple allocations to alternative managers. Oftentimes, they may have significant allocations to 5 or 10 managers that are effectively, let's run with long short, the most common hedge fund type manager. I would have to assume that there must be tremendous crossover and correlation in the holdings. And that's not even factoring in some of the duplicate of the long-only holdings the family may have in other parts, so they're a more liquid portfolio. You're able to effectively x-ray and show, listen, you know, you have so much correlation and actually directly the same equity in this long short and that long short. How often do you come across that? And is it an education for the family, for the CIO?
That's an excellent question, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, Angelo. You're absolutely correct. This is something that families, when we point it out to them, they definitely get it, the aha moment. So I'll name names, and that is that, so if you look in any family office's portfolio that we've ever seen, and you look in their equity portfolio, and I mean their long-only equity portfolio, some of the names you'll see are names such as Apple, Google. One that's very popular this year is Netflix, Michael Kors. So great, your long-only manager, who is supposed to, in most cases, you're supposed to be trying to achieve beta there, beta meaning that you're trying to get the market return, right? And so those are all great companies. So by no means am I bashing Apple and Google. But what the family doesn't realize is that when they go to the silo, which they think is supposed to be uncorrelated or non-correlated or less correlated, that they typically, when they have, if they, to the extent they have any reports or they just even informally discuss their portfolio, they discuss it as two separate sleeves, the alternatives. Guess what? Positions are sitting with their long short hedge fund managers, Apple, Google, Netflix, Michael Kors. So when we aggregate what the family has in those stocks, as an example, most families have no idea that, oh my God, I own a huge piece of Apple and Google and Netflix and Michael Kors, etc. And so it's clearly a great example, a Harvard Business School case study example of a couple of things. One, exemplary of the fact that the family doesn't really know what risks are underlying their portfolio. And two, undue concentration risk. And, you know, after the financial crisis, I was asked to comment almost to the point of ad nauseum at conferences and in media, television, as well as press interviews about causes and lessons learned or not learned from the financial crisis. And one of those things is the fact that you found that many investors, even sophisticated investors, did not realize that they had undue concentration in their portfolio. And so your question is a good one, but that is absolutely correct that most families don't realize how much overlap, how much duplication, and how much undue concentration risk that they have in their portfolio. Because as I mentioned earlier again, they're not able to manage because they're not measuring and monitoring. So they're totally clueless or unaware of what's of this overlap.
In some of the fine public equities that you noted, and those are some wonderful companies that likely
absolutely
at least at the moment are very likely going to be part of a family's portfolio. But when you're hugging beta, and I think I'll use a word that you used with me in some of our prior meetings, and you're paying for an alternative manager that often could be 2 and 20 and also very tax inefficient, you're starting well behind the starting line on something that you're likely already getting beta exposure for. And, you know, we don't mean, neither of us, to be kicking alternative managers. There's some very, very fine managers out there that truly do some wonderful work and are worth every penny of the quote-unquote high fees they charge. But I have to admit, post-2008, and especially much of the last several years, that number is dwindling and it's getting a little harder and a little harder to sometimes find a true value in some of these managers.
And that's why we think it's critically important for families, family offices, SFOs, if they want to know. This is something that a question that I typically pose And it's done, you know, semi-facetiously, or in a cheeky way, you could argue. But if you ask a family, do they have insurance for their house? They'll look at you as if you have three brains. And of course they have insurance for their house. Of course they have insurance for their car. But how many family offices have insurance for their investment portfolio, which I guarantee you is worth more than their house and their car and all of the possessions inside? You know, so, and the way you buy this insurance is nobody has a crystal ball. We do not have a crystal ball at our firm. The family doesn't have a crystal ball. Warren Buffett doesn't have a crystal ball. So the way you create a sound, repeatable, and sustainable investment results over time is by having better blocking and tackling, better processes, better controls, better governance, because that's how you are able to ride the various market and economic cycles. That's what ultimately produces superior risk-adjusted return, and that's what families should be learning as part of their lexicon, is it's about risk-adjusted return. Well, guess what? You can't have good risk-adjusted return if you don't know what your risks are. And so we advise families that if you're willing to spend X amount for your homeowner's insurance or your car insurance or for life insurance, you should be willing to spend some reasonable portion of money to protect your investments so that you have better governance and that you have actionable risk management. Because where it pays off, and this is something that I get asked, they say, well, if I do this, aren't I just increasing the cost line of managing my SFO or family offices? And we say, absolutely not. What you're doing is you're increasing the risk-adjusted performance line, because guess what? Through better monitoring and better processing controls, you kick out all the posers who are not giving you alpha and not giving you your 2 and 20s worth. So you're kicking them to the curb now. That's one thing. Secondly, because you have a better understanding of what is driving your risks, hopefully you can make better and more intelligent risk decisions about optimizing for that trade-off between risk and return. So all of these things are increasing and accretive in terms of creating value, not only in the near term, but in the long term about repeatability and sustainability. So good risk management, good governance, when it comes to the portfolio, more than pays itself when you get rid of a couple of managers that are not justifying that 2 and 20 as an example. So it's more than paid for itself for several years. So that's something that is important for families to understand. It's not increasing the cost line. It's actually improving the risk-adjusted return line, good governance and good risk management.
Although there are many more investment-specific questions I would love to ask, we're heading a little bit to the home stretch in terms of our dialogue today, which I'm greatly enjoying. But I suppose I will bring up a common thought, a question that I'm given by my families and SFOs. You know, we're designing a well-diversified portfolio that is low correlation or as uncorrelated to some of the other holdings that we have. I mean, everyone says that in 2008 proved that in certain horrific markets like that, that almost everything, quote unquote, went down. Nonetheless, the concept of it, by using metrics, and probably let's not get too deep in the weeds on correlation metrics like Pearson's correlation, Spearman's rank correlation, we'll save that for a deeper dive at a point in the future. But I'm assuming there's metrics and analytics that the family and an organization like yours could do that could truly measure whether this part of the portfolio or this specific manager or internal strategy that we're doing as a family really is low correlation to other parts of our portfolio. How do you handle the math and metrics behind that?
Well, the math and metrics for looking at performance and risk, unfortunately, cannot just be calculated on the back of a cocktail napkin, nor can it easily be done in Excel. But the kind of metrics that, again, we think are most important are ones that provide linkage to the risk policy guidelines. So there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of different kinds of metrics that are nuanced that can give you, so I'll give you an example. Let's take, volatility as an example. And people understand that mathematically volatility, it just means it's the standard deviation. And it's another name for standard deviation. Well, I can tell you that for within my professional space, we have very many, many different metrics that can show you volatility split into upside volatility versus downside volatility. There are many derivatives of Sharpe ratio, which is meant as to give you a risk-adjusted return calculation over the risk-free rate. You know, so there's a Trainer ratio and a Sortino ratio and things like that that many families will recognize because when they look at their statements, they don't understand them, but they in some of their individual statements, they may see these metrics. So we think what's most important about metrics is metrics that provide insight and allow support to your risk policy guidelines. So remember, the risk policy guidelines that I mentioned are things like drawdown. And the way drawdown should be looked at is under typically three kinds of scenarios. What does my drawdown look like under sort of more normal market conditions? What does it look like under stressed market conditions? And what does it look like under highly stressed? And so you're getting three different ranges of potential loss. What does my volatility look like? If there was another 2008 and I went to redeem because I needed liquidity, who can I redeem from and how long would it take? So those are metrics that should be monitored. And so those are the kind of metrics that, again, provide insight. And then somebody does not need to be a rocket scientist necessarily to understand them and make them actionable, especially if a process has been documented and exists. But more importantly, it all goes back to the IPS and the risk policy guidelines, which is your governing charter. And that's the same thing as what a good coach does when they have a bunch of plays that they have set that they're going to run under certain conditions. And so it's analogous to that, and that's what a family should be doing. And so we're not in favor of metrics for the sake of metrics. The metrics have to have what we call decision analysis support. And decision analysis is the underlying analysis that makes a process actionable. So our belief is it's not about quantity, it's about quality of metrics, and then the metrics have to be linked to insight and supporting the risk policy guidelines. And that's how a family can then know that they're over their skis and they need to do something. So as an example, let's say that under a highly stressed scenario, their drawdown has crept up to 30%, and the family office's tolerance level is 25%, meaning that they do not, in a severe market, want to lose more than a quarter of their investments in terms of price decline. Well, guess what? In the IPS and some of the accompanying processes that are extensions of the IPS, there was a plan for risk defeasance of what the family is going to do, where they're going to go to cash, where they're going to get liquidity, where they're going to, you know, try to live to fight another day. So if you look at the financial crisis, the families did not need to have predicted the financial crisis, but those who, even during the midst of it, took action instead of losing 38.5%, which is where S&P was, they might have lost 20% or 25%. And you don't need a math degree from MIT to know that you were significantly better off, because just to get back to where you started, you would need to do double. That's the way the math works, as you know, Angelo. So as far as metrics, the punchline is they have to be insight and provide support to making decisions that are already prescribed in the IPS and the risk policy guidelines. Those are the metrics that a family should care about. A lot of the other metrics are interesting statistics, but are not necessary.
We are taking a little bit of a hard look, and rightfully so, that many large families and SFOs fall short on risk management. I think many of them realize that, and hopefully through something like this, our programming and other work that we are doing and others will be insightful and be of value. But given that I am such an extreme advocate of SFOs, I would like to point out, if it makes them feel a little better, and Sam, please comment, it's not like the alternative, well, let's take our money and go to a series of private banks, or let's go to MFOs. And of course, there's some good ones and good teams out there that could do a good job, but the vast majority are not going to be sophisticated in the areas that you're talking about, and are often going to be far more conflicted from a sales perspective. So I don't want to give SFOs the impression, oh, wow, this is so hard, let's just pack it in. There's others we could outsource this to that are going to do a better job. The answer to that is usually going to be no, correct it in-house. But I'm giving my opinion, which is a little conflicted to the SFO side. Sam, if you have any comments on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good area to sort of conclude, and that is that part of the rationale for a family to have an SFO is that they've reached a level of wealth where, from a cost-benefit perspective, it makes sense for them to do it internally, versus paying, as you pointed out, the various, you know, middleman kind of markups and surcharges that many service providers, knowing that the family offices have some wealth, are going to tack on. So it's almost a surcharge for being wealthy. And you're absolutely correct. There are many multifamily office banks, private banks, etc., other than giving you leather-bound books with your initials or your account number in there, are charging you more for the same checking account than if you didn't have two nickels to rub together. So you're absolutely correct that there's not necessarily any substantive value that they're providing. Our recommendation to family offices and single-family offices in particular is the way to do it is, to, in essence, to work backwards. And that to say, what is my objective in terms of investment management, risk management? To achieve that objective, what are the personnel? Should I do this insourced, or should I work with a firm like ours, like our firm? And to do that analysis and decide what makes sense to, from a cost, from an efficiency, from a benefit perspective, and that should be determining how they proceed there. But I think that with the advances in technology and with the advances in that more services and high quality services are available on a managed services or outsourced basis, if singles do it in a smart, strategic way, they can do these things internally, and they should not fear that, oh my gosh, this means that I've got to, you know, go to XYZ bank and be a part of that private bank, or I've got to hook up with five other family offices and I can no longer be independent. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but we recommend that you know, start with your objective or your end goals of what you really need to do it properly, and then do some research. And that's why organizations such as yours, Angelo, are a tremendous resource to family offices and SFOs, because you can be a nonpartisan facilitator to help family offices. And we always think that where family offices should shoot as an objective, given the level of wealth and given the money at stake, is to take a more institutional quality or institutional style approach to investing and risk management of those investments.
Absolutely, I concur. For our families who are listening in and desire to reach out, Sam, if you could share maybe some of your contact info in this audio recording.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. The name of my firm is Global Risk Management Advisors. We're based in New York City on Park Avenue. And if you go to our website, www.gmainc.com, you'll be able to see a profile of our principals as well as our services. And I'd be delighted, especially for the members of the Family Office Association, if they wish to call me. My direct line is 212-230-1610, and so I would be delighted to chat with a family about more about these things. It's something that we feel very passionately about, and it's very, very important for the ongoing future for families as it regards to their investment portfolios.
On behalf of Sam Wan, Founder and Managing Director, Global Risk Management Advisors, and myself, Angelo Robles, Founder and CEO at Family Office Association, we'd like to thank you all for listening. I'm sure you found this of value. We look forward to engaging even deeper dialogues with Sam on this topic in the future, so stay tuned. On that note, Sam and everyone listening, have a great day. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.